Thanks for joining us this morning. Our guests today are Pima County Sheriff Deputies Jeremy Ramirez and Steve Chuk, and they're with Search and Rescue. And I want to ask you guys everything starting from the beginning. How long have you been on the department?
My name's Jeremy. I've been on the department for 21 years.
And Steve? I'm Steve. I've been with the department for 15.
And has your entire time been with Search and Rescue?
Jeremy, no. It's been in patrol, then Search and Rescue. I've been in Search and Rescue for almost 14 years.
And what made you want to do that?
It seemed like a really good assignment and something I was interested in.
And Steve, what made you?
To get into Search and Rescue?
Mm-hmm.
I enjoyed the opportunity to work with people that were in distress and to work with our volunteers.
This is not a volunteer job for you, right?
No, we had a test into this position.
Okay, what kind of a test do they? Do they hang you out of a helicopter on a string? What do they do?
Not quite. So there is a swim test. There is a treadwater test. There is a wildland firefighter pack test. So it's 45 minutes, 45-pound pack, 3 miles. You cannot run. And then there is a simulated rescue. It's about a 3 to 5 mile hike with gear. Then we lower you off of our tower, and then there's an oral board. It's a 2-day process.
And you say a pack test.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? What are you?
So it's a pack test. You can use your own pack. You can use one of our packs. It's on a track generally. And as I stated, you have 45 minutes to complete it. It's 45 pounds in your pack, and it's 3 miles.
Your pack is a backpack that you're carrying, what you'd be carrying into the field.
Okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. I'm new. So I noticed your uniform's a little bit different than the other deputies. Tell me how your uniforms have evolved.
We used to wear the same uniform that our patrol deputies wore, and we found that it was, if we would get called to a trailhead and have to go in the field, we found ourselves having to change our uniform in the parking lot, change our duty boots to hiking boots, change our shirts, take our ballistic vest off. We'd have to carry harnesses in with us. So now we have an external carrier for our ballistic vest. So we just take that off when we get to the trailhead. We all search and rescue deputies wear hiking boots. So when we get to the field, we don't have to change our boots. Underneath our duty belts, we have a harness that will help us when we rappel on ropes or go out of the helicopter. We just have to add leg loops to our legs and then a chest harness that will buckle into our waist belt.
So that you don't fall off the rope.
So we don't fall off the rope. We're clipped into the rope or we're clipped into the helicopter and safetied in it that way.
How long have you been doing this?
I've been doing it. It'll be 9 years for me this December, so just over 8 years right now.
So when you're rescuing people, are they really grateful or are they obstinate and belligerent? How does a person approach a person who maybe not wanting to be rescued?
They're generally very appreciative. There's some embarrassment sometimes involved, which is understandable depending on what the situation is. But for the vast majority of people, they are very appreciative of what we do. We got some people that ask questions in regards to if there's going to be any fees, fines, penalties, anything like that. But no, there's not unless there's a reason to it. But generally speaking, no.
If they're belligerent, there's usually because there might be a medical condition and they're not maintaining properly and they're having issues along those lines.
Off their meds. Yeah, I can understand that. Now, we have the stupid motorist law. Do they have a stupid hiker law?
No, there is not. There was talk of that several years ago. I haven't heard anything come up of it recently. But no, there is no stupid hiker law in Arizona.
Because anything can happen. I mean, you go out there and you're hiking, you can get lost pretty easy. I've seen people who are experienced go, wow, this is, you know, pretty intense. You can't find your way back. What do you advise hikers before they go hiking? What do you advise them to do?
Tell at least one person where you're going that's trustworthy and stick to that plan. If you're going to change that plan, make sure you tell those individuals what you're going to change to. Generally have a time frame. Understand sometimes hikes take longer than people anticipate. Now everybody has a cell phone nowadays, but that's great. Make sure it's fully charged. turn it off, turn it to airplane mode until you need it. Because people leave it on Bluetooth, they leave their Wi-Fi, they leave all that on, and what it does is just drains your battery very fast.
Oh, so, I didn't know that. Turn it on airplane mode?
Put it on airplane mode. If you're going to use a mapping program, download your maps beforehand, leave, make sure they work, because if you get somewhere there is no cell service, you're not going to have that map, you just have a blank screen. Take plenty of water, plenty of fluids. If you, generally speaking, during any time of the year, basically, is if when you're halfway through your water, just turn on and come back.
Yeah, that seems to be a pretty reasonable, common sense thing to do, but sometimes people don't do that.
Yeah, we always generally ask people to carry at least two sources of light, not your cell phone. Your cell phone does not count as a source of light. And then some way to signal, whether it be some, generally, if people have a fire, way to start a fire, that's great, but you got to be careful with that as well at the same time. But that's usually in the gist of what we generally tell people, and stick to established trails. If you do feel like you're going to get lost, or you believe you are lost, just stay there. Just stay put, because it's generally easier to find someone when they, at the beginning of them being lost than at the end, especially if you're with a vehicle or a bicycle. Stay with that, because usually we can find that a lot easier than a person that's running across country somewhere. So our general rule is, if you're going to get lost, stay in that spot. If you need to get to a higher point thinking you get cell service, great, but don't be wandering around cross country haphazardly.
If somebody has a cell phone and you have the number, you know the number, somebody gives you the number, are you able to track them that way?
In a way, yes. If they call into 911, ARCOM has a way to grasp their GPS coordinates, depending on the cell signal service and the way it's triangulated. And if it's a phase one or phase two, which is just the way the cell phone comes in. And generally speaking, those can be very accurate. Say we'll get one within 16 meters, but at the same time, we may get one at 16,000 meters. So it just depends on that. We also have an app that we use. It's not open source app, but one of our volunteers has created it. It's called the ERM Emergency Response Manager. And on that one, we can send them a link if they have texting ability, and they click on the link and we'll be able to grab their GPS coordinates from that. And it's usually very accurate.
Latitude and longitude?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. So if somebody calls in and says, my latitude and longitude is this, you can go get them.
Well, if they're accurate.
Yeah,
if
it's gives us a place to start looking.
Okay. Now, you're talking volunteers. What are you referring to when you say volunteers?
We have a very strong contingent of volunteers here in Southern Arizona. We have rescue divers. We have rescue dogs that go out and search for people.
Bloodhounds?
They're not bloodhounds necessarily. We have had bloodhounds in the past, but they're the dog that our volunteer trains for the task. So we have different types of dogs that are available.
Okay.
And not all dogs, if a volunteer brings a dog in, they can test it. If it's not worthy of the position, then they'll have to get rid of that dog and move on with something that's more appropriate. We have our horseback riders that come in, our SAMSAR, which will help us carry individuals out, or sometimes they'll bring supplies such as water or whatever into the field for us. And then we have our SARA volunteers, which are our hikers. We call them the ground pounders. Those are the people that go in, and oftentimes our first medical on scene is they're going to get to our patients more often than not, more first.
Well, a lot of these people know the area. Like, I wouldn't know anything about these areas. I don't go out hiking, but some of these people really know the area well enough that, you know, they know the little intricacies that...
Absolutely. The knowledge that our volunteers bring to our rescues is, you couldn't even put a value on it. We have to discuss and use their information a lot of times to help us formulate a plan that's the best plan to conduct a successful mission.
For that particular area. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today are Pima County Sheriff Deputies Jeremy and Steve. They're with Search and Rescue, and we were just talking about what you need to do to qualify for this. What does a volunteer need to do if they want to be a part of Search and Rescue?
So there's different component groups their application and their training process is different. I'll give you the example for Sarah. Sarah's the Southern Arizona Rescue Association. Those are, as Chuk said, are ground pounders. They just actually had a applicant process recently, and they have open houses for people to come and have interest. They speak to them, they put an application. They then, based on the application, they narrow it down to a certain number of people just based on sometimes sheer volume that they get. They then go through a background check through the Sheriff's Department because they will work under us. So we have to know who these people are. At which point, once they're accepted, they have a, once they pass that part, they have a candidate hike that they go through. It's just a meet and greet just to see if they can hike a little bit with carrying some gear. And then once they're accepted beyond that, they then go to what's called SALT. It's
Well, a candidate hike also acts as an evaluation to see how they work well with one another and if they've got the ability to be a team member.
Yes. Communicate.
Yeah, so then they will go through a training process that can take several months. It's some medical training. There's some search management training behind it. There's team building behind it. There's some technical rescue stuff behind it, amongst other things. So it can take several months. And then at that point, they're considered a basic and or candidate. So it's a yellow shirt. They can't go into the field by themselves, but they can go into the field with what's called a rescuer, who's an orange shirt, or with a deputy. So
who's a white shirt.
Who's a white shirt, yeah. So at that point, then they can be going to the fields. They start filling out their criteria for their card. It's called an orange card that they fill out. They have to get so many trainings, so many medicals, so many different things they have to process and get and check off on their orange card to be able to come request to become a full rescuer in orange shirt. So it's a pretty good process. It's a very good training. I believe Pima County and Sarah have probably one of the best trained volunteer organizations in the state.
I've seen that acronym, Sarah. I've seen it around and I'm like, what is it? Now I know. Yeah. And people apparently have to go through quite a bit in order to be considered a part of your team.
Well, essentially, I mean, they can potentially, as Chuk said, be the first medical on scene of something that, and it could potentially, it could be life-threatening at that point. So we need them to be very well trained in order to effect that rescue. We also have to trust them that they're going to make sound decisions, potentially under stress. Navigation skills, knowing the trails, as you stated before, knowing maybe some of the shortcut areas to go to. If we have to use a helicopter, they have to be able to work around a helicopter, work around other agencies, work around animals. So there is quite a bit involved with it.
Okay, when you're going to a rescue and you're in a helicopter, what are the things that you do first when you get to the scene other than jump out of the helicopter? Let's go back. What kind of training do you get to go do that, hang out of a helicopter?
Okay, but I'm glad you said hang out of a helicopter because we don't just jump out of a helicopter. we're tethered to that helicopter with safety equipment. We have a crew chief that will put us on our hoist hook and lower us to the ground. So we're on a double safety until we're on that hook. And then once we're on the hook, he lowers us potentially could be 130 feet to the ground from our helicopter. So we have the utmost confidence in our helicopter pilot and our crew chief because we're hanging underneath the helicopter on that cable.
You want to be good friends with them?
Absolutely. So we treat them right at Christmas time. So when we get out there, we'll communicate with the aircraft, and when we are on scene with the patient, we'll determine how we're going to package that patient to get them out of the field if we're going to use the helicopter. We have to have an open line of communication with the helicopter to tell what equipment we need down to us, whether we need a basket that the person's going to be laid out and strapped into and taken to the helicopter, or we have another device that's called a screamer suit. So if we have like an arm injury or ankle injury, we can just set them in the screamer suit, and it's fabric that engulfs their body and just take them up to the helicopter. It looked like a big orange teardrop when they're going up to the helicopter, the way they're suspended. Then we give our patient instructions on what to do when they get to the helicopter, how to grab the crew chief and how allow the crew chief to take control and get them into the helicopter.
Yeah, our helicopter is pretty tight quarters inside. So sometimes people, if they're on a backboard or a stretcher, they cannot go in the helicopter. So they sit outside by the step, parallel with the helicopter at that point, and they're being transported to another area. If they're in what Chuk said, the screamer suit, depending on their mentation and how they are, they can come inside if we can get them inside. Sometimes they have to hang outside the helicopter as well. So it's pretty tight quarters. That's our helicopter. We also work closely with DPS Air Rescue. So they have two different platforms. One is they have a larger helicopter in Phoenix that has a hoist. So they are usually staffed with two medics and the pilot, and they can generally handle almost the entire rescue by themselves. We'll just support them at that point if we need them. They have a smaller helicopters here and based throughout the state, throughout the state, that does not have hoist capability. So they do what's called, some people call it short hauling, some people call it long lining. So it's up to 150-foot line underneath the helicopter that we will then attach the patient to, and they short haul them, fly them to another spot. We can also rappel out of DPS Air Rescue to get to a scene if they can't land or give us into a hover low enough to get to that scene.
Do you remember a couple of months ago that rescue where the basket kept spinning around?
Yes.
What caused that?
I don't know the specifics on that, but if you're making reference to the Phoenix and rescue, is it appeared as though possibly the tagline broke. We use a tagline on a Stokes basket and every time. And then we also use a tagline case dependent on the screamer suit.
In a Stokes basket, and the example that you just mentioned is when our patient is laid out on their back, like on a backboard, and we have control of their C-spine or whatever. They're in that basket, laid down. We have a tagline on it that's supposed to arrest the spin on that basket. But if that line breaks or becomes disconnected in some way, you'll get the spin caused by the rotor wash from the blade above.
Okay, you were talking about hanging out of the helicopter. You said something about you put loops on your legs.
Well, we asked about our equipment earlier.
Yeah, right.
And I said that we have a harness that we wear underneath our duty belt, and it's composed of a belt that goes around our waist, and it has buckles on it that takes leg loops. So when we put our legs through those loops, we have basically a seat that we can sit on that's constructed of our belt. And another component that we have is a chest harness that it gives us another opportunity to buckle into the aircraft, or if we're going down on rope, buckle into the rope.
Okay. Have you ever just had to grab somebody with your arms and bring him up in the helicopter?
Jeremy had an example of that about 2 weeks ago.
Well, that one, but there's another one that's even more prime example is, if you remember, I believe it was 2 years ago when Tankavorty Canyon flooded really bad, one of our rescue deputies had to go get one of the child, and the child is too small, in his opinion, which is probably it's accurate, for what we call the cinch collar or the strop. And so he just held on to the child and took him all the way up to the helicopter on that one. We just had one a couple weeks ago where a guy was, you can call it a clinging gecko. He's climbing, free climbing, just solo with no safety gear, no nothing, not harness, anything. And he got himself stuck on a ledge. So we had to use the helicopter and lower me down to grab him with the cinch collar. And that's essentially what we did. We were able to get the cinch collar around his arms and just grabbed a hold of him with my legs and my arms to help keep him in that position till we got him up to a safer spot where I could transition him from that cinch collar, because it's a little tight. When it's by name, it cinches onto you, so it's pretty tight. And then transition him to what we call the screamer suit so we could hoist him up to the helicopter.
Was he injured?
No, he was not injured. He just was stuck, and he could not move up, down, left, right, anywhere.
How do people get in those situations?
That's a good question. But he did. He was climbing, and it's generally easier to climb when you're going up until you start looking around, you get stuck, and you can't climb back down. And that's the position he found himself in.
Okay. Was it last month, a couple weeks ago, there was a dog that was sunning himself on a ledge?
That dog was in Sabino Canyon up on Blackett's Ridge. And typically we don't rescue animals, but that was unusual where the dog was, and the dog had a collar on with some tags. So it was believed that perhaps the dog was hiking with its owner and something happened to the owner. So we went in and had to check the area. We used the aircraft and had ground teams in the area to see if there was anything suspicious in the area other than the dog. And it turned out that the dog's owners were out of town, and the dog just went for a walk while they were gone a couple miles up into Sabino.
Yeah, it's also, as Chuck was saying, it's unusual because dogs and animals aren't allowed in Sabino Canyon. So that was another clue for us to, we may have to go check that.
How far from home was this dog?
I believe it was just over 3 miles, but I'm not exactly sure.
Not really.
But it was 3 or 4 miles through the desert to where it was located.
Well, I'm glad the dog's okay. He is okay, right?
Yes.
Yeah, he looked like he was really just chilling on that rock. Just, I'm here enjoying the sun. So what is the most unusual rescue you've had to make? They're looking at each other.
Yeah, unusual. So I don't know about the term unusual, but one of the most significant ones was the one I mentioned earlier about the Tankaverde Falls, because I believe there were 16 or 17 hoists on that. It was a flash flood, and people got caught on the rocks in the middle of the creek when it was flooding, and then people got caught on the opposite side. So that was a 2-day rescue. They got most of the people that day, but there was two individuals that they could not get to. So we had to wait overnight. We sent a ground team in to meet with them, and the next morning, another aircraft, DPS Air Rescue, came and got those two individuals.
Did the people that met with them stay with them?
Yes, they stayed with them all night.
Okay.
Those were our volunteers that hiked in.
I was like, okay, it's 4 o'clock, I've got to go.
Well, when our volunteers go in and meet with somebody like that, they're taking food, water, clothing, things to help sustain those individuals through the night, because they were obviously stuck by this storm and had nothing with them. So sometimes the course of action is to wait it out until the next morning and then just come out under better conditions.
Okay, when it's certain times of the year, like the monsoon season, would you advise people who are going out hiking to take different type of gear than they would when it's not monsoon season?
Rain gear is great, but one of the biggest issues we run across, as an example, during the monsoons is people go hiking in Sabino. Sabino is one of our most popular and one of our busiest areas for calls. So they go hiking in Sabino Canyon, up by Seven Falls, either one of those. In the morning, it's great. They can make all the water crossings. There's no water, or it's minimal water, not a big deal. But it rains on top of the mountain, even though it's not raining in Sabino. Depending on where it's raining and how much it's raining, you have anywhere from 3 to 5 to 6 hours. So they go on their hike, they come back, that same water crossing is now impassable. So that's one of our biggest education things that we try to get out to people is, you may want to look ahead at the weather forecast later in the day and up on top of the mountain, because it may not be raining where you are, but that water does come down, and then it creates an issue for us as well as the fire department at that point when people are stuck on the wrong side, they can't cross, and or some people try to cross when they shouldn't be doing that.
Okay. We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back in a few. Thanks for staying with us. Our guests today, Pima County Sheriff Deputies Search and Rescue, Jeremy and Steve. And we've been talking about the different scenarios that you go through, but you also mentioned that you work with the other agencies. Tell me about your affiliation with all the other agencies that you work with.
Other agencies that we work with include local fire departments in different jurisdictions, and oftentimes we'll transfer our radios so we can talk directly with the fire crews and we can share information with them. And oftentimes they might be the closest to a trailhead, so they can get what we call a hasty team started into the field, which is going to be our first medical assessment if we can get to them. And that's really important, because once we have somebody on scene, it will direct things that we have to do to affect the rescue. It will tell us what equipment needs to go into the field, or, you know, whether an air asset is needed or something like that. Besides the fire departments that we work with, our volunteers, which we just can't say enough good about, we've got the Border Patrol here in Southern Arizona that we work with. They're Border Star agents. We have resources at the base that we can use, the air PJs, the pararescue jumpers, if we need their equipment or their expertise. So there's just some of the agencies that we reach out to. And then if we have a large major event that we need a lot of resources, then we'll reach out to other counties and we'll bring rescuers in from other counties that will assist us.
Are you EMTs, paramedics? Are you trained in?
All of us, all search and rescue deputies with Pima County are EMTs, and our crew chief is a medic.
And what's the difference?
He can administer a lot more drugs, and he is a higher level medical care. He has more training.
Okay, and who is that?
That's our crew chief. His crew chief is TJ, Tom Price.
Okay, oh, yeah. I've heard that name.
Oh yeah, he's been around a while.
Okay. Are you saying he's old?
No, he's been around a while.
Okay, so when you work with these other agencies, like the fire department, don't they have their own search and rescue?
No. So I don't know if it's been mentioned yet or not, but per state statute, the sheriff's departments are responsible for search and rescue. So therefore, we're mandated to have a search and rescue unit. It does not state other entities, other agencies cannot do search and rescue. So they are not search and rescue. What they do, they're fire rescue, and that's one of the components they do. They don't have a dedicated search and rescue unit.
Okay. No,
they may have a dedicated technical rescue team, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're search and rescue. They go through some trainings that they do. They are allowed to go out, I'll speak specifically with Rural Metro. They have the abilities to go out and do training hikes to get to learn the areas that we go and have calls with them on. So it's a little case dependent on how far and how much involvement the fire agencies will be on this. Sometimes they handle the call entirely on their own. Other times when we speak with them and we relay the information that we have, they realize that is something that they probably should not go on, and then we will handle it, whether it be something that's several miles in, because they will generally go 1 to 2 miles, maybe more, depending on what the call is. But if we're going to use an air asset, we usually have them at the landing zone, and that's where they're helping us because of their medical expertise. So it's case dependent on what it is, but most of the local fire agencies, they know their area, and that's their area of responsibility, so they will go in and hike as well. It just depends on the case, how far and how much involvement they will be.
So you would bring the person out and then turn them over to the fire department if they're sitting there waiting with an ambulance?
If it's necessary.
Something.
It depends on the injuries. If we bring somebody out and it's better that they're transported by air, we'll have an air ambulance waiting for them on ground. We'll transport them to an air ambulance and send them right to the hospital, depending on the needs of that patient. So each one is evaluated as necessary.
And it can be just an evaluation, and then they decline further treatment, and then they're gone.
That's what I was going to ask. Can people decline treatment?
If they meet the criteria, yes, they can decline treatment.
And what's that criteria?
If they're maintaining properly, if they can answer questions appropriately, and if they generally like to have somebody with them, depending on what the injuries are, and if they have someone that can transport them to the emergency room themselves or to an urgent care.
If we bring somebody out of the field and they sustained a head injury, and we know they lost consciousness and whatever, and they're by themselves, we're not going to bring them out and then say, yeah, drive yourself to the hospital for evaluation. they're ours at that point, and we'll get them in the ambulance and get them the care that they need. We want to make sure that we're doing the best for our people, that we're
handling it appropriately. So not everybody can just say, thanks a bunch, see you, bye.
Absolutely not.
And I know one of the questions you said that's most frequently asked when you arrive is there a bill attached with this search and rescue?
No, for our involvement, there is no fee or there's no bill. Generally, and it's a general statement, and if the only time there generally would be a bill is if there's something majorly invasive treatment done, usually by the fire department, you're transported by ground or you're transported by air ambulance. If you're transported by us out of the field to somewhere using our helicopter is not billed. That's the whole basis behind having a search and rescue unit.
Which is probably a good reason to keep the Stone Garden grant going, to help you guys with your equipment and your, you know, transportation ability. I had a friend who was bit by a snake in Bisbee or Benson and took a helicopter ride up here. And it was $38,000. That's why I was asking.
Yeah, our helicopter, we will not transport to the hospital because that's not its capability. That's not its mission. So if you need to go by air to the hospital, we will get you out of the field. We'll transfer you, as Chuk said, and then you'll go. but our helicopter is not equipped to transport to the hospitals.
It's pretty large, isn't it?
It is, but it's not its purpose. You can't really do a lot of patient care with our helicopter, and that's not its platform.
Equipped that way.
It's not as equipped, and it's not its platform.
And the difference between the helicopters is, like the medevac unit is more equipped, like a little hospital inside?
They have an actual bed that they'll put you in, and it's equipped with a medic, a flight medic, and a nurse.
So,
but that would be with the DPS helicopter as well. If we use their helicopter, that helicopter has the ability to put the patient inside the helicopter, and they can get treatment, and they can go direct to the hospital.
When you're talking about where the patient has to sit on the helicopter, it kind of reminded me of MASH, where everybody's outside, and you get flown outside, and the pilot's on the inside. Isn't that a little scary?
And for the patient, depending on the situation, but probably not. They just want to get out of there. And usually if they're in the basket, they can't see that well anyway. So they're still attached by two points of it on the helicopter. They have the main hoist, and then they have a safety attached to them. So that it's, and we can't fly very fast that way. So it's better than an alternative, either staying there or taking a really long, manpower intensive Stokes ride out.
Where you would have to use a stretcher and carry them out?
Correct.
And that could take hours.
At least.
You said something before the show about, you know, people calling and saying, I need to be rescued, and how quickly can you get here? And your response was?
How long did it take you to get there?
I think that, you know, people need to think of that when they're hiking and, you know, be prepared.
Yeah, it depends on other severity of their injuries. Sometimes we don't have an air asset available, so it has to be done by ground. If it's something that's relatively minor, I mean, I understand people call in, they're upset, to them it's a major issue. But depending on, we just can't throw everything at it. We have to have a measured response to it. So generally speaking, if it's something along those lines that's relatively minor, in our opinion, the way we evaluate it, then yes, it could take us, if it took you 4 hours to hike there, it could take us 5 hours, because we have to get people together, ready, get their gear, and then hike in, generally with a lot heavier pack than what you went in the field with.
And that's probably part of the problem. You weren't prepared.
Potentially, yes.
Okay. Tell me about some of the rescues you've done. And some of the unusual, you know, situations that people have found themselves in where you've had to either carry them out or hoist them out.
Well, one that I find it's interesting is what happens with our weather here in Tucson is we can have like a really nice morning, and we'll have people that maybe start biking off the top of Mount Lemmon going down to Catalina State Park or something like that. And then the next thing you know, they're stuck in snow and they're not prepared for it because they're wearing their bicycle outfits and their bicycle shoes and everything else. And there was a couple of few years ago that I had to go get that they ditched their bikes, and I was able to get to them and get them to safety. And I remember the letter that the mother sent, because the mother was so grateful that I didn't yell at her kids for what happened. But it was just a really good example of not being prepared for the weather and not having equipment with them that they should have had.
You know, people think of it. I'm from Chicago. We used to go out on Lake Michigan all the time, but we were always, okay, what's the weather going to be? You know, you're on the water, you're in a boat. What's the weather going to be? I'm kind of surprised that people don't consider it, because the weather here is just, you know, like you said, the morning's beautiful and all of a sudden it's snowing outside. People don't take that into consideration more often than not.
Well, a few years ago, Jeremy, I had a group of about seven. It was the same thing. They were hiking in T-shirts and shorts on Mount Lemmon, and a snowstorm came in, and they had no cold weather gear with them whatsoever. And that particular rescue was kind of like herding cats, because when we got some of them, they wanted to run back in the field. So we're trying to keep them under control while we're trying to get the rest of their group as well. So
why did they want to run back in the field?
They thought that they could help their friends.
Oh.
Yeah, they'd spread out over at least quarter, 3/8 of a mile. There's people spread out. So it is. And part of the unique thing about Tucson area is the recreational opportunities is you can drive for 15, 20 minutes, you can walk for 5 minutes, and you can be in trouble. You know, the Tancredi Falls is a perfect example of that. A lot of places on Mount Lemmon, people love driving up there. You drive up to the top or anywhere, and then you walk for a short period of time, and you can get yourself in trouble, either lost or injured. So it's really, we're very accessible down here is part of the issue why we're a busy unit at that point.
Does Mount Lemmon have any kind of like search and rescue or anything up there where people are just stationed up there?
We have two deputies that are permanent residents up there on Mount Lemmon, and I had an opportunity to spend some time up there myself before I got into this unit. So they're a really good resource for us because they know where the trailheads are. And when we get an initial call, that what we have to do is verify where someone started from. So they told us they started from Butterfly Trailhead. We're going to contact our Mount Lemmon deputies and see if they can go verify whether a car is there, or a truck or whatever. If not, we're going to ask them to check other trailheads. And since it's 26 miles from the base of the mountain up to the top, some of that is important that we're getting those questions answered before we start up the mountain.
No, because if they don't really know where they started, you'd be on a wild goose chase.
Correct.
So that's pretty important. So what can people do if they're, other than let somebody know, if somebody gets lost, is there a way they can backtrack? Can they mark their trail and then go back? Is there a way of doing that?
I think people have tried, and probably the calls we don't get, it was successful. But obviously the calls we get, it was unsuccessful. Because people have said they've tried backtracking. And it depends. As I stated, if they don't download their map on their phones beforehand, all they see is just a blue dot on a blank screen. So it'd be difficult unless they're laying a track and they know how to do it. That's the other issue is people have this technology, but they don't know how to use it.
Laying a track means on the map on your phone or on your device, your GPS, that you could follow back out.
Oh, so you're not like just leaving breadcrumbs behind you.
Correct.
So breaking tree branches, you see on TV, they'll break a branch and go, oh, they're, you
know. It's TV.
Yeah, TV. It's not working. It's not working. Okay, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a few. Okay, we're back with Jeremy and Steve, who are search and rescue with Pima County Sheriff's Department. And we were talking about the training, the extensive training that the volunteers go through. I want to know a little bit more about these volunteers. They have to be pretty dedicated.
They're extremely dedicated. And depending on what their area of expertise is, whether they're our horse unit or our dog unit, it's not only the training of that individual, it's the training of that animal as well and their capabilities and their skill level. Then we have our volunteers, our ground pounders with Southern Arizona Rescue Association. They've got tracking ability, they've got navigation, they've got their medical certifications that they have to maintain. And these are all volunteers. So it's a resource that we have we're really fortunate to have here in Southern Arizona. We could not do our jobs effectively without the dedication of our volunteers and what they bring to the table for us.
When you're screening volunteers, you know, because you're Pima County, it's a big place, do you have a certain number of people in each like area? Do you break it up into areas, map it out that way, or is it just whoever brings the most to the table?
What we do as far as the screening goes is the background checks on the volunteers. It's for each subgroup, the dogs, the divers, the horseback people, the SARA members, to select who's going to be in their organization in their particular niche. Okay. And work with them. And they have to have that ability to work as a team, that ability to not necessarily be the boss, but maybe take orders and do just the job that needs to be done.
They have to be a good follower.
Absolutely. And because it's a volunteer organization, we have a lot of people that maybe can be with us for a while and then they get a job change or they get promoted or something like that. So there's a turnover to a certain degree. So we're always looking for good volunteers that really want to put themselves out there and be part of a winning team.
But they have to bring something to the table. They can't just like me. I would never volunteer because I have no clue.
Well, we have some people that don't go in the field. Say for our SARA members, there are some people that don't go in the field, and which is fine because we need them to help run some of the background stuff. So they need them to be a truck driver, to get the gear ready, to run
logistics.
Radios, to run, the logistics side of it. So we still need people like that, absolutely. Because in our unit, there's seven deputies and a sergeant. As busy as we are, we can't handle all these calls ourselves. We need all these resources at our disposal, not only just the volunteer side, but as you stated earlier, the fire department, other agencies that we work with, and we request them as well. Plus, we are hopefully a resource for other counties throughout the state, because since Arizona, we're mandated for search and rescue, we have an automatic aid that if Cochise County, as an example, needs people or they need a coordinator, we can make the request through our chain of command, get approval, and go help them. We can send our volunteers there either with a Pima County deputy or without a Pima County deputy. We have the ability to do that. And sometimes they just need Pima County deputies to go over there. You know, another agency, a neighboring agency may need Sheriff One, a rescue helicopter. We get the approval and we can go send that helicopter off as an asset to other places as well.
Do you end up going out into the desert with these migrants that are coming through and walking through the desert? Do you get called, go out to the desert?
We do. ARCOM does get calls with those, and a majority of those are transferred to Borstar and Border Patrol.
Okay.
Because that's their area.
Huge.
And especially if it's on the reservation, obviously. If it's not on the reservation, they still get the calls transferred to them, and then we have to follow up to see what they need, if they need any other assistance with those calls.
Are they allowed to go on the reservation?
Who's that?
Borstar?
Absolutely.
Border Patrol
and Borstar.
But the county sheriff isn't?
Generally, we do not, because it's an entirely different nation. We've gone on there before when we've assisted Borstar. We've assisted DPS Air Rescue, who's assisting Borstar. It's just a train, the way it goes. But we have done that in the past, absolutely. But it's not one of our primary jobs, is going onto the reservation.
So you know when to take the lead and when to be the follower in different situations, depends on where the tragedy, I call it a tragedy, happens.
Yeah, and as we stated earlier, in Southern Arizona, I believe we have a pretty good network of the way we work down here with other agencies and knowing how calls are supposed to pan out. So I think we have a pretty good system down here.
How does somebody apply to be a volunteer for search and rescue?
Go to sarci.org, sarci.org. It's Search and Rescue Council Incorporated. And that is the umbrella organization that oversees all the other component groups, the five other component groups, and they will have their links on there, and you can look at the different websites.
Now, when they're applying to become a volunteer, do they put on their application, I have a horse or I have a dog?
Yes, it depends.
I have a trained cat.
At that point, once they go to sarci.org, it'll have the different links for the other organizations. Say you said horses, so that's SAMSAR, Southern Arizona Mounted Search and Rescue. They'll have the link on there. They can click on that. It'll go to their website or their Facebook page or whatever that is, and they can make contact with that group and organization to find out information from it. And that goes for every one of the other component groups as well.
Oh,
so if you have a dog, you go to the dog side. If you just want to be a ground pounder, you go to the Sarah side.
What kind of dogs typically do you guys accept?
Or it's not that we accept dogs. It's the group organization. It's a dog that has the ability to be trainable and to pass certain standards, because there are standards that these dogs need to test into and to be able to pass. So I'm not a dog guy. He's more like my answer.
Each rescue deputy is kind of assigned a group that they work with. And I work with our dog unit a lot. So we've had bloodhounds and we've had shepherds and we've had sheepdogs, like Australian sheepdogs, and different things like that. We've had Labradors and we've had Golden Retrievers. So the thing to remember when you're looking at the animal, like I said, it's the training of the handler as well as the animal themselves. And then there's a lifespan that's involved with that animal, where you can only get so much work out of that dog, and then they're starting over again with the handler will be starting with another partner.
A new dog.
Correct. Or a new horse. We're fortunate with the horse that we have down here. Our horse team is there, one of the few, if not the only, in the state that will transport patients on a horse, not just supplies, but patients.
And mules.
We have to say some of them have mules.
How do they do that?
Just ride them out. The horse end of the mule is that well trained and has gone through that much training to be able to have the confidence from us and the handler to be able to put a patient on there that's willing to do it and capable of doing it and walking that person out.
Example of that is they'll ride their horse in, we'll put the patient on horseback or on mule, and then they'll take lead on the horse and walk the horse out while we've got positive control of the person that's sitting in the saddle so they don't fall off. You know, we make sure that we've got rescuers standing by so we don't create a worse situation than we started with.
So who trains the dogs?
The individual handlers train the dog.
And they also have state conferences and trainings in state and out of state that they go to.
We'll actually have, later this month, we'll have 2 3-day sessions where they'll have different instructors in working with them on different...
What do they get trained for?
Oh, there's 3 major disciplines. There's tracking, trailing.
Okay.
There's air scent and what's called HRD, human remains detection. Those are the 3 main disciplines for dogs.
So they have to be trained to do that. They have to pass a certain test.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Just once or repeatedly?
They have to maintain that certification. So annually they have to go through and make sure that they're meeting the standards that's required. And if not, then there's remedial training that's going to have to be done, and they're going to have to go back and then retest.
It seems like the dogs that I know, the canine unit from TPD, they're constantly training. And that'd probably be the same situation for one of your rescue dogs.
Correct. You can't just train the dog now and expect that you're going to come back two months from now.
Yeah.
It's going to be able to respond in the same way.
So that's really quite a commitment.
All of our volunteer groups train at least monthly. Some of them are weekly or biweekly. So they all have different training levels. They train a lot.
That's awesome. I mean, to be a volunteer and have that type of commitment.
Well, even our volunteers, what we keep saying, the ground pounders, our SARA volunteers, some of those are technical rope rescue people. Some of them are trained to deploy out of the helicopter if we need to put them into the field. They maintain their medical certifications.
They hang out of a helicopter too?
Not on Sheriff One, but they will out of DPS Air Rescue.
Okay. That's pretty impressive.
But it's not uncommon for us to go in and set them down up trail and then have them hike down to where a patient might be.
What's the most memorable rescue you've done? They're all memorable.
I honestly don't have one. I mean, the most recent one was just that guy that I stated earlier was a clinging gecko on the cliff. That's just because it was most recent. And it was something that was very unusual.
No,
it's
that
not something
was
we do every time.
It was actually pretty spectacular. I mean, that was very, very fortunate for that climber that our crew chief and pilot and Jeremy were all working really well together, like a well-oiled machine, and we're able to get him out of a really bad situation, because where he was stuck, he was without water for an hour plus. He wasn't dressed for the weather. He didn't have any kind of safety equipment. He wasn't tied in. So it was just his desire to hold on to that rock that kept him in place until we can get the aircraft there to get him.
When I vision this in my head, I'm thinking somebody's hanging on the side of a cliff with his fingers and his toes, and the helicopter's rotating, blowing him off the rock.
Well, that was the fear.
That was a concern.
I was talking to the subject when the helicopter was coming in, and that was his fear, that he was going to get blown off the rock. And I told him all he had to do was hang in, and we'll take care of the rest of it from there.
It was about a 50, 60-foot hoist, so it wasn't as bad as it could have been.
Okay. Well, I want to thank both of you for coming here.
Thank you.
Bright and early. And not getting called out while we were on air because you're on duty. I like your hats.
Thank you.
It's pretty impressive. And next time I see a white shirt, I'll know. You're search and rescue.
Very good. Thank you.
Very cool. I appreciate you being here. I want to remind everybody that shop local, stay safe, and donate to the Humane Society. They're having that big impact lunch today. And we'll talk to you next week.